Hello, and welcome to the Writers and Illustrators of the Future podcast. This is John Goodwin, your host. This podcast is dedicated to the aspiring writer and artist and will provide inspiration and tips from top professionals in the field. Today, I'm happy to welcome a guest who is a Writers of the Future winner, published in Volume 36, Andy Dibble, with his story, A Word That Means Everything. He's also been published in Sci-Fi Journal, Starline, Speculative North, Sci-Fi Lampoon, and he is the articles editor for Speculative North, a Toronto-based science fiction fantasy magazine. As an undergraduate, he completed four majors, religious studies, philosophy, Asian studies, and computer science, and published a paper on two of India's great epics, the Mahabharata and the Bhagavad Purana. And for all those of you from India, I'm sorry if I butchered it, but I really wanted to make a shot of that. He holds a Master of Theological Studies from Harvard Divinity School. Welcome, Andy.
Hi, John. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I'm really happy that when I sent around the last podcast that you responded that you'd like to participate. And I'm very anxious and very excited when I'm able to have new writers on here who are rapidly escalating up in the ranks of writerdom. So first of all, you're obviously a writer. You're one writer of the future. So how'd you get started with your writing?
So I wrote kind of on and off when I was a kid. I mean, I didn't have any kind of grand vision of being a writer. But I mean, I wrote some fantasy, some horror, I guess. I mean, not very seriously. And I didn't really actually plan on publishing anything professionally until I, my previous kind of job, when I left that, I was under a non-compete for a year, so I couldn't keep in that career. And so I'm like, I'm going to write a novel. And I wrote a fantasy novel, and that's sitting. It's finished more or less, but I'm not too proud of it, given how I've changed it as a writer. But kind of actually what kind of drew me to start writing short stories actually was, the idea for A Word That Means Everything. So that was the first kind of short story I wrote when I wanted to start submitting short stories to magazines. And it wrote pretty quick, actually, although the beginning was very long, very info dumpy. And so when I first submitted it, it's Writers of the Future, I think in early 2018, it got a hard reject. And then I submitted it again, I think 9 months later. And that's, it won. And I was quite surprised because at that point I hadn't published anything yet.
So that's great then. So that was your journey up. And since winning Writers of the Future, because in your intro, I read several things that are happening. So it seems like things have definitely expanded for you. So a little bit about that then, please.
Oh, yeah. So, I mean, I kept kind of, submitting, stories. And I write a lot more kind of idea-driven fiction. And that's why, I've sold a few different stories to Sci-Fi Journal. Because, that's kind of their focus. But probably the biggest sale I've had in terms of my kind of, writing career since Writers of the Future was a story kind of grounded in kind of classical Buddhism, actually based on an older Indian Buddhist epic called the Buddhacharita. And my story was called The Bang the Drum. I sold that to Speculative North, that Toronto-based magazine that you mentioned. Mm-hmm. And so I got involved with their science fiction and fantasy writing group. If there's one kind of silver lining to COVID, it's that we're much more global now, that we can just get on Zoom and meet with people in other countries. Right. From there, I did slush reading on Speculative North. The lead editor for the magazine, David Schultz, he needed some help with copy editing, and I helped with that. And now I'm articles editor for the magazine. So I work on, like, you know, the craft pieces, you know, the interview, the introduction, you know, the nonfiction pretty much. And now my new project is working on a science fiction and fantasy anthology of religion-based stories. And so the publisher that's affiliated North, you know, is affiliated with T.Spec, you know, we just came out with a Kickstarter for that just today. So that project is, you know, off to the races.
Well, that's good. So now, absolutely, the whole subject, I mean, one thing I definitely want to be able to discuss with you on this interview is religion and science fiction and fantasy. So just in preparing for this interview, I read Bang the Drum as well. And you're very much, obviously, your understanding of religion and various religions, based upon your first story that you won your Writers of the Future with, and then now with this Bang the Drum, is obviously shines forth. So on the subject of writing religion in science fiction and fantasy, do you have any basic philosophy on that, or basic rules, do's and don'ts that you follow?
So I'm not sure if it's like a basic philosophy. I mean, because, you know, religion is just like, it's so big and so nebulous, right? You know, it's integrated with art and law and, you know, practice and philosophy and you know, literature and script. I mean, it just has so many, you know, aspects that,
sure,
like, I don't kind of have a core, like, a big algorithm for it. But, right. I mean, if I do have a mission in you know, in writing science fiction and fantasy, you know, and kind of, you know, and helping the field, you know, in how it engages with religion, like, I am, I guess, dissatisfied with, you know, some common trends. Like, it's very common for, you know, religion to kind of be just, you know, the gods just kind of, you know, are used to give characters magical powers in a kind of, you know, Dungeons and Dragons way, or it's just used to set up a political dynamic, or, you know, the work is very critical of religion in general, you know, treating it, you know, with abstractions. I mean, I even see that kind of thing sometimes in you know, pro magazines, and sometimes they even get their facts wrong, which is pretty embarrassing if you're criticizing something you're getting your facts wrong for. I mean, it's not common, but, and so it's like, I mean, it's actually why I like seeing when you find, you know, sci-fi and fantasy that takes, you know, religion very positively, you know, kind of as a counterbalance to you know, some of the negativity that you see. So something like, you know, Walter, you know, Miller's, you know, A Canticle for Leibowitz.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, I mean, he, Catholicism is a very powerful, you know, positive force in that book. Or I read The Parable of the Sower by Octavia Butler recently. And that, I mean, she writes beautifully. The book's kind of depressing, though, really.
Yeah.
But religion there is that, you know, that very strong kind of positive, you know, thread through the whole book. And I mean, I like to see that because it just, you know, very refreshing in this field.
Yeah, it's because it seems like sometimes an author will try to, or writers will try to grind an act somehow or another, the way they describe religion or go over like the negativity of religion. Whereas yours, both the stories of yours that I read, it isn't that at all. It's almost like, it's not that it's impersonal, but it's just a straight, here's a fair shake at something. Here you have, you know, a word that means everything. You know, that's the proselytizing of Christianity right across the galaxy. And Bang the Drum is the, I guess, the herald of the Buddha. You know, which is, you said that's a takeoff from a story, or that's similar to a story, or that's, or is this your take on how the Buddha came to arrive?
Yeah, so it's, the impetus for that actually was, so there's it's first century, epic called the Buddhacharita, written by a man named Ashwagosha. His name means horse sound. It's very interesting. so that's kind of the most famous classical biography of the Buddha. Mm-hmm. And there's one episode in there where the sage Asita, who he's you know, very illustrious sage, and he comes in and he starts, you know, he sees the infant Buddha and he starts crying. And the king, you know, is very distraught about this because he's worried that that means something very bad for his son. But the reason why Asita's crying is he realizes that he's going to die before the Buddha is enlightened and teaches, you know, what he's learned about the world.
Right.
And you know, Asita dying first means that he won't be able to be enlightened and be liberated from karma and rebirth. So it's kind of that moment of tragedy. And in Indian literature, there's actually very little tragedy. It's most things end well. So it's a very touching moment for me. Yeah.
And then with that Tamisra, the one from, she actually came from, you know, she lived her various lives in hell, but how in this story that you wrote then, how she was actually purged or whatever, and she actually then regained a new life because of her touching and holding the Buddha infant. That was pretty interesting, that whole, you know, the restoration of her karma, of her soul, or whatever you want to refer that. I thought that was very interesting too. That was just, it really was a good ending.
Oh, good. Yeah, that ending was harder for me. I had to smooth it over. After, when I first had that accepted, they didn't like the ending, so I kind of had to work with it. But yeah. She I invented. She's nowhere in okay. the Buddhacharita or any source I know of.
So that's why it's called science fiction or fantasy.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. I mean, we take many liberties here. I actually did
alternate history. This is really just alternate history.
Yeah, I actually submitted that story to Critters, you know, which is an online writing workshop. And I actually did have a Buddhist say that they thought it was history. And so it's, you know, you get all types.
Yeah. So you said when you sent me the story, Bang the Drum, that was a very significant story for you. How so?
I mean, it's like, you know, I guess primarily in terms of like, you know, my writing trajectory, it was. I mean, probably what's most meaningful in it, you know, for me, you know, was that episode in the Buddhacharita. Probably the other thing could be that, like, it does have more of a moral message than probably any of my other stories. And, you know, being didactic in writing is normally frowned upon, and for good reason. I mean, it's good to have a much, you know, more subtle touch. But, I mean, like, you know, one message there is that, you know, anger, you know, isn't productive, that it's destructive. And that's, you know, especially true in a Buddhist context, but, you know, not only there. And that is one thing I wanted to, you know, to convey.
What was good about that, because even though it is a moralistic story that you've got there, it didn't come across that way because it is about the Buddha, it is about karma. And so the very nature of what those subjects are lends itself to having that type of a story and have it being told in such a fashion that I didn't want to reject it. You know, it wasn't one of those points like, oh, he's banging his own drum now for his own philosophy. And it didn't come across that way. It was a very fun story. You know, I really enjoyed it. And now that you said this, it does come across more as maybe an alternate history rather than just straight fantastical, you know, that you've written there. But now you've mentioned a lot of stories, and a lot of people I talked to in an interview talk about it's important, character is important, and story is important. But you've taken it and you say for you, what's important is the idea and building on an idea. So you like to make ideas the center stage. And that was very obvious on A Word That Means Everything. I mean, my gosh, that was the totality of it, and that totally explains that story to me. Okay. But what's your, you know, so how is it that that's become your trajectory on writing stories?
Well, I think a lot of it is that, I mean, my background is more academic. You know, I think, you know, very, very, you know, philosophically, and, you know, I still like that kind of thing. I mean, I still write like philosophy and theology nonfiction too. But like, I mean, with a word that means everything, I kind of had some ideas for characters, and but like the core of it, the concept was, you know, just, you know, translating, you know, for me it was translating, you know, the Gospel of John, you know, part of the Bible, you know, into, you know, alien languages. And I thought that, right. I thought that was really cool. And, yeah. And, you know, and it grew in this way where, like, you know, kind of, you know, so many alien cultures. And so, like, how, you know, is kind of landscape morphed in a way that you know, I maybe lent itself somewhat more to a wider audience, even though, you know, there are just tons of ideas. Yeah. And I like the ideas, and I'm going to, you know, keep, you know, liking the ideas. It's not going to change about me. I mean, if there is kind of, you know, maybe something I want to achieve in terms of the field here, it's, I mean, I think stories, you know, I'm a pluralist, so I think stories can succeed for, you know, lots of reasons. You know, it, you know, a great concept for a character, you know, humor, you know, really, you know, beautiful writing, you know, strong pacing, you know, a great plot. And I tend to think that at least, you know, most editors, and I don't know, you know, readers, it depends, of course, but, you know, there aren't that many, you know, magazines out there for idea or world-driven, you know, fiction. You know, there are a few, you know, like Nature Futures, and I mentioned Sci-Fi Journal. I did a newer one, you know, After Dinner Conversation. But, you know, there aren't that many. Which, you know, somewhat surprises me because, you know, there are a ton just for, you know, kind of generic sci-fi fantasy. And, you know, normally that they're saying, you know, they want, you know, a good story. And by that, you know, they mean focused on characters and plot. And that's great. You know, stories, you know, can succeed that way too. But I don't think, you know, that should be, you know, like, you know, indispensable always.
Yeah. Right. Like, who's your favorite author?
Favorite author? Ever? Probably Jorge Luis Borges, as we just kind of leads in from what I just said. But I mean, yeah. His stories are very idea driven. I mean, well, and he's also a good humorist too, which I really appreciate. I don't think there are, I mean, you know, good humorists are, they aren't common, at least.
That's for sure.
I mean, like my favorite writer probably writing right now is Ted Chiang. I mean, some of his stories I find, like, you know, more impressive than a lot of Borges' stories. I mean, but like, Chiang isn't a good humorist like Borges is. They're both, you know, very, very remarkable writers, though.
Right. Okay, good. So, yeah, I'm just curious if how it makes sense then that you would gravitate towards idea-driven authors as your... as somebody that, you know, you enjoy reading based on what you're just talking about and what you like to write in stories. Now, so you recently originated that you're editing an anthology of religion, science fiction, and fantasy this year. So tell me a bit about that, you know, just like what you're doing and what's the goal of that?
So broadly, the goal is to kind of improve representation of the treatment of religion in the field. So, I mean, it's not so common for there to be, you know, stories in the field that actually focus on real religion, you know, Christianity, Buddhism, you know, et cetera, you know, Islam. I mean, there's often a focus on kind of, you know, religion in a fantasy concept, context, or far in the future, you know, where it's so fantastical that its connection to kind of, you know, the real world is strained. And I mean, there actually are some magazines that explicitly say they, you know, prefer not to have those kind of stories precisely because, you know, they can kind of, you know, turn readers off, you know, they can offend some readers. And so that's one goal here, to actually give, you know, more, you know, representation to, you know, stories that deal with, you know, real religion. And we had brought in readers from the University of Toronto Interfaith Center. You know, we have 5 readers, you know, taking a program there that will be reading submissions for kind of, you know, treatment of religion, you know, ensuring that the stories are, I guess, you know, sufficiently sensitive to the topic. So that's one piece of it. One thing like I want to see here too is just that a lot of treatment of religion in sci-fi and fantasy it's not always like Christianity per se, but behind this treatment of religion is a very Christian idea of religion. You know, that religion is what happens, you know, in only one aspect of your life, or it's what the monks in the monastery do. And normally in, you know, across the world, it's far more common that religion isn't, you know, what you believe, it's what you do, or maybe what you feel. In Islam and Hinduism and in Judaism, like, what you actually do is a far larger component of your religious identity than simply, you know, believing a certain kind of creed. And that's one thing I want to, you know, have in these stories too, is that, like, you know, religion being kind of, you know, part of the characters, whole lives and whole identity, rather than just kind of one aspect.
So that definitely comes across in, at least in the first stories that I've read of yours. So that's basically your idea behind this compendium you're putting together. Of, are you writing them all, or are you getting several authors to submit stories?
We have an open call starting later this month, and then we'll be open again in May. We're taking both reprints, you know, already published stories, and you know, just new unpublished stories. We'll see what we get, but hopefully many submissions, and then we can sift through them for the gems.
So now we've got, here's this anthology with one story by A. Dibble and one by Andy Dibble, another one by Andrew D. And
oh, no, I mean, at the moment, I don't plan on putting any of my stories in it, but I mean, we'll see. It's my first, you know, real editing project. So,
right.
We'll see what it takes to produce a good product.
Yeah. And then depending how it's going by the time you come out for the awards of event week, we definitely have some of our judges that'll be more than willing to help you as well.
Oh, answer nice. Any questions.
Yeah, they'll definitely assist with you. So on the subject then of writing, like our audience as aspiring writers and artists. So with respect to yourself, so you're rapidly moving up that curve as a professional writer. So what particular things have you had to overcome to get to where you are? Because you've got your regular job, you had your obviously your learning curve that you did going through school, and then maintaining your work ethic to be able to keep the house that you're living in there and feed everything. How do you fit that in, and how do you envision it expanding for yourself?
So I guess in terms of challenges, I mean, a lot of it is just keep submitting stories. I mean, I sold one story that after 19 submissions, I have one that I've submitted over 20 times. That one's been interesting because it's been held on to by 4 pro magazines, one of which rejected it because he thought it would offend readers, unfortunately. But he had very nice things to say about it otherwise. well, yeah, it's just, you know, writing about religion. And I mean, a part of it too is just, you know, kind of taking the opportunities that come to you. I mean, that's one reason why we're talking right now is, you know, kind of coming out of my shell and you know, doing things like this because they lead to other opportunities.
Yeah.
And I mean, the major reason why, you know, I'm an editor for Spectrum Up North is just because, you know, I wanted to help with copy editing and the main editor, you know, liked my feedback. So it can be very small things, you know, joining the right writing group, you know, even something like Critters. I mean, I've built, you know, somewhat a relationship, you know, with, you know, someone that, you know, was a finalist for multiple Hugos and a Nebula, you know, won the you know, Bram Stoker just because, you know, I submitted a story there and we got talking and, you know, now I'm you know, you know, helping him edit his novel. So, you know, little opportunities can lead to much, you know, bigger things. In terms of, I mean, like the future for me, that's something that I think I probably should strive to get a clearer picture of. And I think that's a good idea for, you know, really any writer, because your goals determine so much of how you really, you know, should behave. Like if you're, you know, dead set on this being, you know, your career, you really have to be going to, you know, workshops, to conventions, you know, building those those connections. You know, you have to, you know, really figure out how to publicize yourself. And, you know, and how to, you know, go the self-publishing route or, you know, make those top sales and, you know, catch the eye of, you know, major, you know, traditional publishers. But on the other hand, if your goal is what possibly mine is, you know, just to, you know, keep publishing, you know, build relationships, you know, let writing be an important part of your life, but not like your big thing. Then it's fine to be, you know, somewhat more casual and just kind of focus on you know setting goals and you know writing for 2 hours every day and just seeing what comes of it.
So that's where you stand right now, and then, but obviously, success can also change direction too. If all of a sudden you meet that agent that says, "I love this, get me something more." And all of a sudden now you know, I'm talking to the next Tom Clancy now, Stephen King.
Oh yeah, maybe, who knows? Yeah, well, like, I mean, I didn't see myself, you know, really writing poetry or being an editor until fairly recently. I mean, I started slush reading for Spectrum Up North and I found out that I enjoyed it more than I thought I would. I didn't, you know, really, the first poem I wrote, I think in 8 years was the first poem I sold to Starline. And like that poem, I had read, so F.J. Berkman, she's another winner from the same quarter I won. So she is, I guess, the interim editor for Starline, you know, the magazine of the Science Fiction Poetry Association. And like, you know, I had read her little chapbook, a catalog of the Further Suns, you know, that won the Elgin Award. And, you know, I liked it a lot. I told her that, you know, you got me, you know, writing a poem. And I emailed it to her. And then, you know, she liked it so much that she wanted to publish it. And I hadn't even submitted, you know, the poem to her. To the magazine. So like, it's that kind of thing that, you know, I like having, you know, new opportunities open up and, you know, seeing yourself grow, and that can happen in many directions.
Right.
So, yeah, I don't know what will happen to me, but I plan to keep, you know, kind of trying new things and
plugging away.
Yeah.
So last year we released the Owen Hubbard Writers of the Future online workshop, and you said you're about halfway through it, but I'm just, again, this is for, on behalf of aspiring writers who are listening to this interview, to get specifics on our topic we've got is religion in science fiction and fantasy. but also now you started this thing. So what did you get out of the course of what you've done so far?
Okay. Yeah. The early on, there was an essay by L. Ron Hubbard. It was like magic out of a hat.
Yeah.
And like, it caused me to start thinking of like, you know, taking something very, very, very mundane, like a hat, and turning ideas out of that. And so it's like, it helped me realize that like, I don't have to go to some, you know, read these three books and to, you know, get ideas, but you can just kind of, you know, look at some everyday object in, you know, and think about, you know, it in a new light, and ideas are much easier to come by then.
That's great. So on, now with respect to your writing in short fiction versus novels, you've got the one novel written. Are you planning on moving back into novels?
That's an excellent question. Because what I'm trying to figure out really is when is an idea kind of worth a novel? Because my style has really gone more towards being concise. And I've written some longer stuff. I mean, I have actually, so I do have a novelette coming out in Inkton Gray's survival anthology soon. And that novelette was based in the same world as my novel. So I went big and then I went smaller, but, yeah. But I mean, I'm writing some somewhat longer stuff still, but I want to, or I need to figure out, you know, when is this idea that like started out as a novelette or a short story, like when to grow it into a novel? And I don't know. I mean, like my current writing project is another story in the same world as a word that means everything.
Right.
And, you know, actually has one of the same characters as protagonist. So, I mean, maybe I'll keep writing stories like that and then stitch them together into a novel. I mean, something like Cloud Atlas. That was short story stitched into a novel. Yeah. I mean, it can work.
It definitely worked. But, okay, you're mentioning Octavia Butler, but, like, I don't know if you've read anything by Nnedi Okorafor. She's one of our judges, but she writes African religion. She has hers in that vein, and then Orson Scott Card, he writes a lot of religious fantasy. Even, you know, the movie coming out later this year, Dune. I mean, that's very much religion plays a large role in that, and it's a big part of it, you know. But he's built a whole story around that basic idea with the Bene Gesserit.
Is that how you say it? Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's how I said it. Maybe you say it a different way. It's like, that's a downside.
I don't know how to pronounce that word.
Yeah, I read, okay, that's how it is in my head, and you're reading it a different way. Like, we've already established that. I'm trying to, for me, reading the titles of those two books, Indian classics, at the start of this interview here, I definitely said what I said, but it wasn't necessarily the right way. But there's a lot of, you know, the great story ideas that then expand to make it into a novel. Maybe it does require to build story around it so that you can get some more meat on the bones. Because you've got the, you know, like your one story here that you just, the one I just read, Bang the Drum, was great. But you said there was another book that this was a section of from the first century?
Oh, yeah. So... there was one episode in that first century epic, the Buddhacharita, that I kind of grew Bang the Drum out of.
Right.
And I mean, most of Bang the Drum was, you know, just invented. I mean, some of the characters, of course, you know, the Buddha's father, the sage Asita, you know, they're in the epic, but I had to kind of, you know, read, you know, invent them a bit, because I mean, you know, ancient characters, they're a little flatter, right? They're kind of these, you know, flat heroic, you know, kind of, you know, somewhat maudlin or, you know, over dramatized people. So, I mean, it requires a lot of imagination still.
Sure.
Even for something, you know, pretty small like that.
But even like the whole history of Vyplava, is that how you pronounce her name? The one that was.
Vyplava.
I mean, she herself, I mean, it's an amazing backstory on that, which you gave in a paragraph, which could have been multiple chapters that led into how she, the significance of why, you know, at the very end, you know, the tears coming for her eyes and crying, that the significance that would be even more pronounced. You know, I mean, I could totally see how that could be expanded into a much larger treatise than the short story that you did. I really enjoyed the short story, and I'm glad you gave me that to read because I had time to read it between last night and this interview today. But that's, you know, I could definitely see some of the stuff expanding into novels.
Yeah, and that's the thing I need to figure out, because, like, it's always an option to expand something. It's just not... I just don't know when to do it. And like I had thought about, you know, revisiting, you know, kind of, you know, my characters and world, you know, for a word that means everything, you know, for a while. But whenever I did that, I always thought, oh, you know, but it's already, you know, so good kind of as it is. It's just already a whole, you know, why tear it up and try to reassemble it?
Yeah.
And, but it's only recently when I realized, oh, like I have this problem that I want to, you know, solve in a story. And then I realized, oh, I can do it in a world I already have. And when you have that, that's when it kind of makes sense to grow it out. But I'm not sure I want to force it otherwise, though.
Yeah, so see, this discussion is really good because this is something that a lot of writers have to deal with, you know, especially aspiring writers that are on their own personal journey to make it. And so some try to go just novel, and some go short story to novel, some go novel, then short story, then back to novel, like in your case. So it's just your story and just being able to talk it out here on this podcast for those listening. It can give them a little more either reassurance that they're not messed up because they're not certain what their future is going to be yet, because it's not certain. You need to make the future whatever it's going to be, and the quality of storytelling, and also the fact that you're a winner of Rise to Future. You're going to meet a lot of judges who are going to be very happy to deal with you and treat you as kinfolk. Now you're not, you know. When you see them, Tim Powers is going to be Tim Powers. It's not going to be, you know, I mean, he's going to refer to you as a fellow writer. And that's one thing that in the past that winners have like been amazed with, that these judges are so willing to take them in and to accept them as a fellow writer, as a fellow author. And we've had several that have, you know, had considerable assistance in getting that first break from judges who say, here, let me just introduce you to my agent, or different ideas. Yeah, send me your next story and I'll blurb you for it. So that type of stuff will also be afforded you, which provides even more opportunity. Again, there's this podcast, which up until recently, you know, it was, it didn't exist. I started after volume 35 and it's now grown to being a pretty good representation for the aspiring writer to listen, find out other tips what to do. So anyway, what would you have to say to an aspiring writer of what, you know, do's and don'ts?
Other than kind of the perseverance and the you know, figure out your goals, like I already said, and to take the opportunity. So I'm kind of, you know, dropping these nuggets as we go. But I mean, one thing I think it's important to realize too. Is, I mean, there are many kind of forms of success in writing. And, like, I mean, if you're a swimmer or a runner and you're, you know, several milliseconds slower than the next guy, you know, you're in some measurable way, you know, worse. But with writing, you know, there are so many ways to do your own thing. You know, it's a very very, you know, immensely broad field. And you might write a story or a novel that no one has done before. And, you know, even the guy that won, you know, 10 Hugo Awards or whatever. And so, like, I mean, that's really why, you know, I like, you know, when writers, you know, try to do something new and original and, you know, have some fresh idea. And so, like, you know, look for a concept that hasn't been tried. That's, I think, an important bit of advice. And I mean, I tend to think the best way to achieve that really is to kind of, you know, be a generalist. That I think that this actually is something that Damon Knight recommends in his writing, one of his writing books. But like, it's that, I mean, sometimes you have to dig deep into, you know, like a certain century or a certain time period to really, you know, really get the feel of it, to describe the setting or how people act. But I mean, all too often that's something someone else has already done. And if you want to kind of, you know, blaze a new direction, I mean, you know, it comes from kind of, you know, reading broadly, you know, in lots of little areas, you know, read law, you know, read art, history, read, you know, some, you know, read the Quran, whatever. And then figure out weird ways to put them together. And you'll find that, like, you know, a lot of things come alive that way. And I mean, my reading, you know, when I'm reading, you know, for a goal, because I want to make some new connections, you know, it makes everything become much, much fresher for me. So read nonfiction and not just, you know, fiction.
Good. Okay. That makes good sense on that. Now, in terms of the future of Andy Dibble, we've already talked about the one novel, the anthology you're putting together right now. Any other stuff you've got coming out?
I have, other than that novelette I mentioned, you know, based on the world of my novel, coming out in Inked and Gray Survival Anthology. I have a few poems coming out in Staroline. And then we'll see. I mean, keep submitting, keep grinding away. Yes, you know, more of these stories I got to sell eventually.
Yeah, exactly. So if a person wants to be able to find you, where do they go? Where do they find you, either on website or on your social media? How does somebody find you?
I do have a website. I have andydibble.com. I mostly blog there about religion and philosophy stuff, some other things too. It's not really themed because my thoughts aren't very themed. I do have a Twitter now, AndyDibble2. That was an effort to kind of, you know, get more into the self promotion thing, because Twitter really is the major social media platform for writers. And so, I mean, I have a fair number of followers, I guess, but they're all like writer people.
Right.
So yeah, I mean, that's another way to grow myself, but I had resisted on Twitter because I didn't want something else to distract me, like so many other things already do.
Yeah, I'm tracking. Okay, so this has been great having a chance to talk with you. And I think specifically also on the subject of religion and science fiction and fantasy, because it's a lot of people are actually trying to write it, and a lot of people don't realize how much it is in science fiction and fantasy. And if properly done, it can be really good. And if not properly done, it can have adverse effects.
Oh, yeah.
For both your career in terms of, and also for people reading it. So we're not talking about the part where it's intended to actually incite hate, but we're just talking about right now just so that engenders an appreciation and admiration for the author and what they're writing.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So anyway, thank you very much. And thank you for listening. Subscribe to the Writers of the Future podcast wherever you get your podcasts. We've also been syndicated on the United Public Radio Network, where you can find these podcasts as well. Writers and Illustrators of the Future are contests created by L. Ron Hubbard to provide a means for the aspiring writer and artist to be seen and acknowledged. It is free to enter and open to amateur short story writers and artists of science fiction or fantasy. Again, thank you very much, Andy.
Yeah, thank you, John.
Dory Goldsmith, who's in the bottom screen here, is an optometrist from Alabama, and she's been a long-term supporter of the arts, and as we're going to be talking about that too. But I was very excited when Joe, having received this iPad, which she gave him, that has all the different stories from the Golden Age, which are these great stories written by Owen Hubbard in the 30s and 40s, which Joe's going to be talking about, like he was just referring to there, that were recorded as audiobooks in the old radio theater format. So, hello.
Hello. And everybody kind of froze for me.
Okay, well, hey, no freezing allowed here. There we go. No freezing allowed. There
we go. Yeah. We can hear you.
Yes, my lovely face should reappear here any minute.
Exactly.
But Dory, welcome to the show. Tell us
anyway. So,
good.
Okay. Hello. My name is Dory Goldschmidt. I live in Birmingham, Alabama, and I'm an optometrist. And I'm still working and practicing and helping keep people's vision healthy and clear so they can continue reading awesome books. I mean, I love the audiobooks, but there's something about just reading it and interpreting it that I like as well. But I am a big, big fan of Galaxy Press and what author services do. I'm a big fan of a good story, and the LRH's pulp fiction stories are just hilarious to me. The characters are awesome. They're short enough that I can read one and finish it, and just it makes me laugh out loud. So I was able to... I don't know. We'll explain how Joe got one from this optometrist.
No,
But I have some very good friends at Author Services and Galaxy Press, and we, one special lady and I, came up with this cool idea of, you know, I would love to share it with everybody in the whole universe. But I'm just an optometrist from Birmingham, Alabama. But we thought of, how about let's share these for people who might appreciate them, and that way they can tell other people, well, much better than I could. So anyway, that she said, well, I know this guy. He loves LRH's books. He's a big fan. He helps us. He promotes the writing contest, which I love. And we sent him one.
There's your iPad.
Yeah. And it's like the easy button for readers. Boom, push the button. I call it punch them in the face. Boom, punch it in the face, and the story starts. So,
I love it. So I'm just telling you. I'm going to tell you, thank you again, since you're right here in public with us. But
yay.
This thing is great. I enjoy it. Now, it's been fun because I get to tease a lot of people with it. You know, we give away a lot of books on the network, and especially during the holidays, we give away a ton. So ever since people have seen this, because it was back there where the case is, and people started seeing it, and they're like, well, when are you going to give it away? I'm like, what do you mean, I'm not giving it away. So it's been an ongoing project now for the last 2 months. I've been getting steady emails. Oh, well, are you going to give it away this holiday? John was laughing earlier because one lady called me, a friend of mine. Well, you know, eventually you'll get through with it, read it, and you'll just give it to someone. I said, I'm not giving it to you. I said, guys, there's enough material to keep me busy for a couple of years. I said, there's both audio and video. So I said, I can enjoy it. I can listen or I can read. And, you know, and things I want to read, I can always put it on audio, Sam, or something, so it'll talk to me. It's just a nice thing to have because, I don't get to relax anymore because everybody's always got me running in 500 million different directions. So this is an easy way. And I was on the phone with a customer a while. One of them was playing the one about, I can't think of the name of it right now, but it's about a secret or some type of weapons. And I was really enjoying it. My customer called me, and I was like, look, dude, what do you want? And he's going on and on and on. He said, what's that playing in the background? I said, oh, that's something from Elon Hubbard. I said, you probably don't even know who he is. Oh, I know who he is. I'm like, okay, well, I was trying to listen to it before you rudely called me and interrupted me. Now, what do you want? So I go back to listen. He's like, well, you being rude? I said, no, man, it's Friday. I was enjoying the ride. It's a nice ride in this morning. It's, you know, pads on a seat. It's playing. I don't have to worry about it. I'm just listening. And I said, no, you got a call with some BS battery. He's like, well, I'll just let you go back to your listening. I was like, and then when I seen him later in the day, about 2 hours later, he's like, when'd you get that phone? I said, oh, some friends of ours are the Writers of the Future in Galaxy Press. And they're like, really? Can I get one? I said, yeah, here, I'll give you the place to go buy one right now. And he's like, well, what's on? I said, why don't you go? I said, here's the website, which later on, ladies, we're going to put this up. But I said, here's a website so y'all can go look around and peruse and get and see what you want. Because I think it's a great thing, especially when it's all loaded. I mean, there's so much stuff in there. John talked me into listening to something later, and I'm going to start listening to it. I'll be brain dead in a couple of months, so don't worry about it. But, Dory, this thing has been great, and I've been telling everybody about it. And it is really funny because the other night I was doing a show out of New York City, and we got to talking about writers on off chance kind of thing. It wasn't even what the show was about. And I said, well, you ever heard of Writers of the Future? And we went through the whole spiel about, you know, how y'all get in the course. Because, you know, it took a little convincing of John. I'm not going to lie. We've been talking on off now 4 or 5 years. And I'm always leery when things sound too good to be true. You know, it just, so when I started to finish, it's free. We don't want anything. Or you can win awards. You can come be part of school. It doesn't cost you anything. It's a blind thing. Nobody knows who you are. The whole time I'm like, no, man, you're BSing me, man. I said, no, it didn't bring to Emily's pretty face to try to smooth it over. I'm like, no. I said, I'm being suckered in here. I can see it coming. This is going on. And then I realized, no, they're exactly who and what they said they were. And to me, that's a blessing. Because I'm not real easy about promoting anything. I don't really live my name too much anymore because a lot of times I find that stuff is not what it appeared to be in the start. But this is exactly what it is. I tell everybody to take the course, even though I'm losing hair because of this course. I'm telling you, it's costing me hair because I'm trying to concentrate on writing anything, which is I could just say has been, if I put a videotape in here when I'm doing a course, it would be literally hilariously funny. I mean, because I'm cussing at the thing. I'm looking at it. God, I know this is going to work this way. But guys, I'm telling you, if y'all going to take the course, we're going to put it for a little while as well. You really get a lot out of it. It actually has helped my writing. It's made me pay more attention to how I'm thinking about things. It's also made me pay more attention about my grammar. Because honestly, when I'm writing, my grammar is, how can I say this politely, non-existent. Poor John's got to have a reference chart just to read when I'm 70 minutes of time. And for anybody listening who knows me, yes, it is JoJo Ease. That's all my hosts, all the former hosts, all my managers, everybody who's worked for me in the past will tell you they call it JoJo Ease. It's my own personal shorthand. It's my brain works too fast. My fat fingers is what it is. But anyway, welcome, guys. Not Emily Dory, welcome to the show. So, Dory, how did you hook up with these guys?
Well, I met one of the people who work at Galaxy Press when I was in California. I mean, we were in a coffee shop, I think, and she just said, "Hey, are you a reader?" Because I was reading something. Because I'm always reading something. And I was like, yeah. And she had some information with her about the Pulp Fiction books because she was trying to get them into public schools, right? So we struck up a conversation, and she showed me kind of the program they were. I think it was even the pilot they were just starting it of getting these books into kids. And I was like, I've never heard of them. I've never seen them. And she gave me one of the books. And so, it was about this big. And I took it home. And I just read it, like, before I went to bed one night. It was just a funny, funny book. It made me laugh out loud. And I've been doing some serious stuff all day. So that was such a nice reprieve. And so she gave me her card and her number. And I called her. This was before texting. And was it before cell phone? I don't think so. I called her and I said, hey, I want to help you. And so we kind of slowly started trying to figure out how I could. And because I want good things to read. I want our kids to read good things. And, so we actually put them in every school in Alabama. So they're in their libraries. So, and, it's amazing all the books that are like boys would read. Most of the books look like they're for girls. And so.
Well, a lot of them are in Alabama. And I got a lot of friends in Alabama, and I shouldn't say this because they probably smack me when they see me, but most of my guy friends aren't real big readers. And a lot of it is lack of stuff. To put this in, a good friend of mine, Richard, a couple of weeks ago, we were talking about something. He's trying to write a book himself, and that's what I was talking about the course. And he's like, Joey, he said, when I was growing up in this state, there just wasn't much to read. He said, a few libraries would have some sci-fi in it, or they had some mystery in it. He said, but most of it was just books that I just weren't interested in. A lot of it was the Southern history. I mean, we grew up with that, so we don't need to be taught that. So, he said, it just wasn't conducive. And he said recent times, and it might be because of Yon, but he said in recent times he's been finding a lot more books that are readily available. He said that a lot more schools now. His son goes to a school outside of Birmingham. And he said he noticed that he's actually getting into a little bit more sci-fi, and there seems to be more books. And he said he has noticed books coming home with it that doesn't seem to be school issued. And it seems to be something he's interested in. And I can understand it because, you know, I went to a lot of private schools, so it was a little different for me. And first, I went to Catholic schools, which was just nightmarish, which was bad, what can I say? And then I went to private schools because, you know, my mom said, you're too bad to go to Catholic schools. We're going to put you in private school. So it was a little different. You know, in private schools, there's always a lot of material to read. There's a lot of stuff around. They take the time to really educate you. And for me, it was different. They encouraged We went to 6 operas a year. We went to 5 ballets a year. We went to special reading courses. We went to go meet authors. And it was just a different way to go to school. And it's a shame that kids, not all kids can experience that, because I also did, when my dad passed away, I also went to public school for 2 years. And I was, when I changed, I was in 10th grade. And I was like, what a complete and utter waste of time. Everything, when I became a junior at East Jefferson, there was nothing I hadn't had 2 years earlier in private school. Nothing I had. And as far as reading any kind of material, because I was bored at school, I was looking for something to do while they were teaching to the kids, because I was just going through the tests like there was nothing. And there just wasn't nothing there. I mean, it was just garbage. It just was pure garbage. So it was just a waste of time. So I like to see anybody who's willing to help out to get young minds thinking about other things in their video games and the nutcases we call politicians. They need a break like the rest of us do.
Totally. They need that fantasy. You know, watching my grandson, I have a 7-year-old grandson, and one of his favorite things to do is watch other kids do stuff on YouTube. I'm like, oh my gosh, let's go outside, let's do something. And he loves it, but you got to pull him away from it. He has an awesome imagination, so stories spark that, you know.
Man, this mic is having difficulties tonight. It does. I gotta say, I grew up on a lot of sci-fi. It helped me get through a lot of stuff when I was young. I used to get these horrific nightmares when I was 9, 10, 11 years old. In a way, it was a good thing. I hate to say it like this because, one, it encouraged me to do a lot more sci-fi reading. And I still remember the psychologist told me one day, the school counselor actually goes, maybe it's them sci-fi books reading. I said, no, actually, it's in between the sci-fi books I'm reading and the Star Trek episodes I'm watching. I've been able to train my mind. When I feel a dream kick in, I can take control of it and make it into either one of the stories I was reading in the book or a Star Trek episode and participate in it, which I didn't know, by the way, was a big deal. Nobody ever told me as a kid. What the hell did I know? I found out later on when I was taking advanced psychic courses that, that was a big deal. I was like, oh, well, okay, I didn't know that. But it was self-taught, and that stuff really helped me get through those early years all the way through. When my dad died when I was 16, believe it or not, sci-fi helped me get through a lot of that. It was a good way for me to just disappear without being angry all the time. I was raised.
There's a virgin.
it helped me in a lot of ways. So anybody who's out there helping people who can get interested in any good reading, I mean, you know, reading is just a good thing all the way around. Lots of people in my family read. I wish I could read like my wife or the kids do. I mean, they're like, oh, books. Oh, okay, I'm done. Book. Wait, I'm done. 500 pages. Oh, man, that's a short thing. You need to read that. Yeah, I'm like, what? So at one time before Hurricane Katrina, we actually had almost 4,000 books in the house. But, you know, because I get a lot of guests who send me books. And if they send a signed autograph, I put it on the file. Well, what happened when Katrina came in, we didn't necessarily get a lot of water in our house, but it got just damp enough that every book in the house swelled. They were useless. They went from, you know, this wide to like this wide. They were just, and a lot of them just melted. And I was so we're still ongoing recovering that collection of books. And we get a lot of people who donate books every year, but it's an ongoing thing. We used to have a paranormal sci-fi ufology library in New Orleans that we do live in library out of the house. Say, look, come bring what you want, you know. See, and because a lot of neighborhoods, and this, I see this a lot in Alabama too, I see it a lot in East Hill and Pensacola and a couple other places. They had those little book, what the hell you call them? They're just little book boxes outside of somebody's house with 10, 20 books in them. But like in East Hill, it's 30 of them in one neighborhood.
Nice.
So I was like, you know, and down here where I live in Henderson Point, there's about 15 of them. And, And, you know, people don't steal anything, they break, and you see books there all the time. You know, a lot of them are good books. I was surprised. A lot of them are hardback. I was like, really? Okay. And people want to share. Well, East Hill and Pensacola is an artiste community. I'm going to say it right so I don't get in trouble. And where I live here in Henderson Point is slash a vacation and artiste community. So I'm not exactly sure how I ended up here. I have about as much art talent as a rock. I pick up all the time. But if I draw a stick man, I'm not sure if you know what a stick man is. So it's bad. I have talents, just not in any of the artistic things. I can't draw. I can't even sing in the shower, so I don't pretend like I can.
Yeah, one of the things I was talking with Dory about earlier was just on the stories themselves, how they're like, they're all like PG, you know? So like, these are stories that we've got people that are, you know, the grandparents, but we've also got the kids and military. Everybody's able to enjoy these things. So just good, fun stories. And it's one of the reasons why, you know, we're so excited to be able to talk to you about it tonight, because it is going to be applicable to everybody. We've done a lot also in other countries, you know, for English the second language. Just makes it, because we got the audiobook, you have to listen to on there, you can listen to the audiobook and read along the book, and it just improves their English. So we've got a lot of people in a lot of foreign countries that listen to these stories, but because there's no profanity in it, they can enjoy it and doesn't violate any religious codes.
Yeah, somebody was trying to talk me in just 3 days ago, I was reading something off the pad into the book. And to one of the chat rooms. I was on air, but I was reading. And they're like, why don't you just let us play? I said, no, go buy the damn thing. I said, that's the whole point, that teaser. I said, listen, you know. I said, man, you sit here and play this thing. Because we did, which one we did? We did the, it was the 50-hour one last New Year's.
Oh, yeah, and Battlefield Earth.
We did Battlefield Earth last New Year's. And just before that, we had done H.G. Wells, we did War of the Worlds. Yeah. And, Orson Welles, and the thing of it is it's just a nice feature. There's three now, so we did two operas, basically two operas, and then with the Johnson, and with a nice flow. And I still remember this lady. I was actually in Blue Mountain Beach, Florida, which is a beautiful vacation. I was actually in watercolor as well, really was. And so I'm down there, and this lady calls me on the 273 number. We have a calling number, 504-273-7379. And I pick up the phone like a dummy. And because I'm supposed to be relaxing, you know, because I got this thing on full. I know it's good for 50 hours. I don't have to worry about it. So she's calling me, asking me all kind of questions. I said, I'm going to give you the site to go to. You can look. This woman must have called me 30 times. My wife was like, yeah, there or something. I said, apparently so. It's a crazy woman from California. But she was enthralled in it, and she couldn't get enough of it. And I said, well, it's going to be playing nonstop. I said, so it'll play, and then in a couple of weeks it'll play again because of the people. You know, I said, nobody's going to sit there and listen for the whole 50 hours. I said, now where y'all can catch it, whatever you missed as it's playing. But it did really well. I mean, a lot of people listened to it. A lot of people enjoyed it. There's great sound effects in it. There's just great actors in it. I got to say, what's his name plays Travolta's role better than he did. Oh, what is his name? I just seen him today, too. Man, went right out of my head. What is the guy, the voice actor? He's got a great voice.
Was it Chris Carroll?
He played
Charlie Davis.
Oh, yeah.
Charlie Davis.
He's got a great
voice.
He was cracking me up, and actually, you know, it's just fun to listen to. And for me, it's easier because I can let the backside of my brain escape while I'm doing something else. So it can be playing on a computer, or it can be playing on the side, and I can be listening while I'm posting archives, doing this, doing that, We're working a bid for a day job. Joe's actually doing that just before college. Us putting bids together for a construction job.
That's what's pretty good, because I think when we first worked with you, we gave you the flash drive, that audiobook and the flash drive, right? That little,
yeah,
the drive for the Battlefield audiobook. Is that how? Yeah, so it's a real cute little thing. You can get at galaxyprep.com. All 50 hours of the audiobook is like.